It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Starting Saturday, the Pennsylvania Department of Health is adding Tourette's syndrome and anxiety disorders to the list of qualifying medical conditions for patients to qualify for medical marijuana. Joining us on the line from Harrisburg is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Dr. Levine, thanks so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Levine, why anxiety disorders and why Tourette's?
So the advisory board for medical marijuana has developed a specific procedure to evaluate new conditions. And so a patient or a certified physician will petition our medical subcommittee for the advisory board. They will examine those conditions and the literature and then present that to the board during our quarterly board meetings. And so in our board meeting in February, a number of conditions were proposed, and the board voted to recommend to me adding anxiety disorders and Tourette syndrome. And after reviewing the literature very carefully, I approved anxiety disorders and Tourette syndrome as conditions for which medical marijuana can be certified.
Why did those two meet the conditions in your mind?
Those two conditions met the criteria to be approved because there is significant evidence in the medical literature that medical marijuana can be beneficial for patients with anxiety disorders and for patients with Tourette syndrome. Where other conditions, there really is no literature. For those conditions, I was impressed with the literature enough to approve them for certification for patients.
This literature, does it involve research or the use of medical marijuana for those conditions in other states?
Yes. So it involves use in other states, other research projects that have been done using medical marijuana in the United States and other countries.
That brings the list of approved conditions, I believe, to 23. Where does medical marijuana fall in the line of defense? Could it be the first thing prescribed? Are physicians more likely to try other more traditional treatments first?
So that's a good point. So when I approved the conditions, I had a number of recommendations for physicians that are in the program, the pharmacists that work at the dispensaries, and for patients. So for both conditions, anxiety disorders and Tourette syndrome, medical marijuana is not first-line treatment and should not replace traditional treatments. For example, medical marijuana would not replace counseling and therapy for patients with anxiety disorders and would not be the first-line medication for either condition, anxiety disorders or Tourette syndrome. And I also recommended that patients continue to pursue counseling and therapy to help manage their illness, even if they are also taking medical marijuana for this condition.
With what you know so far, is medical marijuana meant to be a long-term solution?
Well, it depends on the condition. The evidence for anxiety disorders is more for short-term treatment than for long-term treatment. But there are other conditions for which it may need to be used longer. For example, medical marijuana is indicated for children and adults with intractable seizures, with epilepsy and seizures that cannot be controlled with other medicines. People don't always grow out of seizure disorders, and then medical marijuana would be indicated for long-term treatment.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Other approved conditions, you mentioned a couple of them, include ALS, autism, cancer, epilepsy, HIV, AIDS, Parkinson's, severe chronic or intractable pain, and more. Are you receiving any feedback from physicians about the effectiveness of medical marijuana treatment for their patients?
So the feedback that we received has been very positive from both physicians and patients, but we need more research about medical marijuana for all of these conditions. And last week, we had a summit about the research program, and this involves eight academic clinical research centers. Those include Penn, Jefferson, Temple, Drexel, Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, Penn State, Pitt, and Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine, to discuss the research that they intend to pursue. So we are hopeful and optimistic that Pennsylvania will become one of, if not the leader, of medical marijuana research in the country with this innovative program.
What questions do you hope they can answer through their research?
Well, many different questions. For example, medical marijuana involves many different compounds, and it has varying levels of different substances. So that includes, for instance, THC and another compound called CBD, and they're different. For example, in my recommendations about anxiety, I pointed out that medical marijuana products with low THC and high CBD in the literature seem to be most effective for treatment of anxiety disorders. But we need to know more about that for all of the conditions. What ratio of CBD and THC is most effective? How is it given? It can be given as a pill. It can be given as a liquid. It can be used in a vaporization device. Which is the most effective way to deliver the medicines? And so, lots of different questions. And we need this Chapter 20 research program, when it's up and running, to provide us those answers.
And, of course, THC being the compound that would lead to a high, correct?
That is correct.
But marijuana is still federally designated a Schedule 1 drug. How do you work within federal confines while also learning what you need to know?
Sure. So first of all, we strongly feel that medical marijuana should be rescheduled by the DEA so that it is not a Schedule I compound. But second, the medical marijuana law specifically allows the Department of Health to have an application for academic clinical research centers, and that has been done with the 8 centers that I spoke about, including the University of Pittsburgh, and to have application processes for, again, what are called the clinical registrants, which is the grower, processor, and dispensary component, and then to encourage and be part of clinical research on medical marijuana. So that is going to be starting in Pennsylvania over the next year.
Has the federal government been a roadblock to your research?
The federal government has not been a roadblock to our research program, but I think that being a Schedule I substance in terms of the whole country has been a roadblock, and if it's rescheduled, it would actually stimulate research throughout the country, not just in Pennsylvania. But we are proceeding under our law.
So what do you think are the best case scenarios for Pennsylvania and patients interested in marijuana as a medical treatment option going forward?
Well, I think that we have one of the best medical marijuana programs in the country. We have specific grower processors that have been inspected and certified, specific dispensaries which have been inspected and certified, and all our products go to laboratories to make sure that of the quality and safety of the product. You know, over 1,100 physicians who are part of the program. So I think we have an excellent program now, and the Chapter 20 research program will really bring us to a new level over the course of the next several years. So I think that the future is very bright for this medical clinical program to treat serious medical conditions in Pennsylvania.
Final question, and here in Pennsylvania, are other serious conditions being considered for approval at this time?
Well, so again, the next board meeting is coming up in August, so we will see what conditions, what people have sent in applications to our medical subcommittee of the board. The medical subcommittee will bring that to the board for their evaluation, and then the board will make their recommendations to me. I don't know what conditions are being, have been applied for at this time, but we will know in August at the next board meeting.
Dr. Rachel Levine is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
In 1999, the Dave Matthews Band set out to make a new record with legendary producer Steve Lillywhite, but they weren't happy with how it turned out, so they shelved the project and worked on another album called Every Day. Well, in March of 2001, those initial recordings were leaked in the early days of Napster, and it turned out that fans really enjoyed the unfinished Lillywhite sessions. A year later, those songs would be re-recorded and released as Busted Stuff on this day in 2002. At the end of 2018, Chicago noise folk artist Riley Walker released a song-for-song cover of the Lillywhite sessions, which is what you're hearing right now. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. If you're an online shopper, you may know we are now in the midst of Amazon Prime Day. The online retail giant debuted Prime Day back in 2015 as a midsummer answer to Black Friday. It's attracted, at last count, more than 100 million shoppers across the globe. But here in Pittsburgh, at least one small business owner is rebelling. Matthew Buckholz is the creative mind behind the tall tales and revisionist musings of alternate histories. If you've been to a local craft show in the last 10 years or so, he's the guy hawking prints of historic Pittsburgh and other cities tweaked to include aliens, robots, dinosaurs, and even a crazed-looking Andrew Carnegie wreaking havoc on the skyline. Because Buckholz says, quote, "everything is better with monsters." Matthew, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So in one small pocket of the Twitter sphere, you've become pretty locally renowned for your annual rebuke of Amazon Prime Day. What inspired your protest?
Well, it's funny. It's not something I plan, but just this morning I was my girlfriend and I were watching the Today Show, and you know, they're running all these things talking about Amazon Prime Day deals, and it just strikes a chord with me. I think, you know, because look, there are some people who want to use Amazon maybe because they have limited mobility or you can't afford certain things. And I get that. I'm not trying to make someone feel bad who uses Amazon, you know, if it's like the easiest way for you to get supplies. Or some people, if you have limited means, I get it. Like, I'm not here to try to make those people feel bad. But that's not what we're talking about. And that's not what Amazon Prime Day is about. Amazon Prime Day is this, similar to Black Friday, this created way of stoking consumerism and trying to get people to say that here's a deal on, you know, an Apple monitor that's never on sale. Here's a deal on things. It's so much of it is things you don't even need. And at the same time, you know, none of it, very little of it is supporting, you know, small independent businesses. It's almost all major brands who, in order to sell on Amazon, have to, you know, agree to work with these incredible discounts and sales. They're taking a cut in their revenue. Amazon doesn't take that cut from the revenue. And I just felt like it was enough. I'd had enough. And so I started, I think last year, saying, you know, I'm going to tweet out for every person who likes this tweet, I'm going to tweet the name and website of, I think last year it was all local businesses. This year I'm trying to say things that are like anywhere you can shop online that's small and independently owned.
Mm-hmm. So if Amazon Prime Day is a little like Black Friday, your protest, so to speak, is a little bit like Small Business Saturday then?
Absolutely, yeah. And Small Business Saturday, you know, that also was a thing that was created by American Express. But, you know, it has its benefits as well. And I always say if it gets people out, if it gets them to a local store, if it gets them supporting someone small, you know, I'll take it.
So how do you choose which fellow small businesses to promote?
Well, I start with people I know, people I've worked with, people I've bought things from, and that's kind of the easy part. This year, it's getting away from me a bit because it's already up to 200 and some likes on the tweet, and I've done about 40 so far. So
a little behind schedule.
A little behind. It may be an all week long project, working as a small business owner, you know, attending craft shows, being part of the Pittsburgh small business community, going out and meeting people, you know, a lot of these things are just off the top of my head. I can think, oh, so-and-so would be great, or, oh, they do a great job. And a lot of it is in trying to share both places people know, like someone like Commonwealth Press, who a lot of people are familiar with, and they do a lot of printing for me, but also out-of-town companies like A Favorite Design from Chicago, who just does some of the best card design and printing I've ever seen.
Do people ask to be included?
Yeah, a couple people have asked. I think people are shy themselves to ask, but what you'll get is people saying, hey, you should do my friend, or hey, have you looked at so-and-so? But I'm, you know, if it, I'm happy to look at things, and you know, at this point, by all means, send me your suggestions, because we'll see how long it takes me to get up to 200.
And the volume of tweets that you prepare is pretty astronomical in the grand scheme, because these are not small amounts of information. It's not just a hyperlink. They read a little bit like a Yelp review. You've got photos included and maybe a personal anecdote here and there. Why is it so important to you to include that personal touch?
Well, I think because it's... The personal touch is important to me because it's saying I can literally vouch for these products. You know, I'm not just, in general, I don't want to just grab something, you know, online. I'm like, oh, this looks good. You know, sometimes small businesses, it might look like it's a small business, but maybe it's owned by Coca-Cola, or maybe it's part of a larger shell company. Maybe they have bad business practices. So it's easier when it's things that people that I know, people I've met, people I've bought stuff from, and I can actually vouch for and talk about it. And I think that's the best thing about being part of, you know, the artist and the maker and the small business community is, you know, you're right away, you have this whole wealth of people that you've met in your travels that you can speak up for.
Not to put you on the spot, but who are your favorites for 2019?
Ugh, my favorites is definitely tough. My expertise is a lot in like the craft and maker world, but I'm trying to reach out of that a little bit. There's a twofer called Black Brew Culture and Fresh Fest. Black Brew Culture is a local organization here in Pittsburgh run by Mike Potter. It's all about trying to get people of color and get more diverse representation in craft beer, and they have a great line of clothing and t-shirts.
And that second annual festival coming up soon?
Yes, coming up August 10th, and you can also buy tickets for that online. So I wanted to put those out there as a way of saying, hey, here's a fun thing you can do. You're still supporting local. You're still supporting independent business owners. Something very personal and close to me is I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I included the website for the Santa Cruz Chili Company in Tumacacori. If you need to buy any chili powder or spices or salsas, I really recommend their stuff. They don't have a Twitter presence. I just put their website on there. But anytime I go home, I like to go in there and get some chili powder and things.
If people listening have suggestions for you, how can they get in touch?
Absolutely. Just tweet at me. I'm on Twitter at althistories, all one word. And like I said, I it's over 200 right now. I don't know what it'll be by the time this you hear this. So this may be a longer project than anticipated. But if you have a recommendation, I'm happy to check it out.
Matthew Buckles is the visual and digital artist behind Alternate Histories, whose work here in Pittsburgh remakes history with monsters and robots. We'll have a link to his art as well as the lengthy Twitter thread recommending small businesses around the region at our website at WESA.FM. Matthew, thanks so much for making time.
My pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Residents of Homewood say gang violence and the war on drugs were at their worst in the 1980s and 90s. Tougher sentencing laws meant many of the community were locked away for years. As part of our series, Homewood Bound, 90.5 WESA's Onley Herring reports the neighborhood still grapples with the effects of mass incarceration, while those freed from prison try to make it their home.
A house stands quietly on Homewood's Monticello Street. All the windows are boarded up. Shingles pop off the eaves. And if you look closely, you can see graffiti beneath a fading layer of white paint. The graffiti is blue, the signature color of the Crips gang. Amber Sloan joined the gang in high school and remembers what the house was like 30 years ago.
But this was just like a regular back porch, and we used to sit up there when it rained and sell drugs and sit on the steps.
Sloan says her mother struggled with mental illness, and her family was so poor she had to steal food to eat. She says no one at home intervened when she started to sell drugs.
I was just doing it because it was a struggle growing up, and my goal was to hustle until I was able to get my money together for when I went to college, you know what I mean? And so instead of going to college...
Sloan was arrested several times shortly after graduating from Homewood's Westinghouse High. She ultimately served 15 years in federal prison for carrying a gun as a convicted felon with a substantial record. Sloan's story is familiar to Dave Jenkins, who owns a barbecue restaurant in Homewood. He actually made it to college, but sold drugs to pay for it.
Like, I had a scholarship, but I was hustling coming home to have money to go back to school.
Jenkins went to prison for drug offenses in his 20s and says he didn't know any other way. His father got sick when he was young, And with his mother working multiple jobs, Jenkins was left to his own devices.
Then, you know, the streets will teach you. You're going to learn one way or the other. You know what I mean? So.
Elsewhere in Homewood, resident Zena Scott says these stories were common in the 80s and 90s. Scott bought a house here in 1976, partly because she thought her kids would be safe. But drugs crept into the community just a few years later.
During that time period, it was scary. The two bars down the street that were nuisance bars, you never knew what was going to happen. Shootings, people driving up the street, running into cars, trying to get away from something. It was crazy.
Scott was especially concerned because her children were teenagers. Many kids their age were dealing and using drugs. As her grandkids play outside and chimes blow in the wind, Scott remembers chasing dealers away from in front of her house.
This was where I lived, and this just couldn't happen here. But it was a fight. It was a big fight.
Scott says she was angry that her neighbors didn't take more responsibility for helping to police their own community. But she says she was arrested on her sidewalk after trying to break up a fight between three undercover officers and a drug dealer. John Welch is a Pittsburgh police chaplain and Homewood native. He says tensions between the police and the community were high during what was called the War on Drugs. Welch says for decades, policymakers believed they were targeting the root cause of crime and neighborhood decline.
They knew that there was violence. They knew that violence was connected to drugs. They wanted safe communities. They wanted safe streets.
But Welch says substance use didn't decline. Meanwhile, African Americans were more likely than whites to be arrested for drug offenses, even though both groups used drugs at similar rates.
And it's unfortunate, but, you know, the powers that be thought it best to create a war when one didn't need to exist.
The tone of policing in Homewood is different today. At a recent open house at the local police station, a parking lot fills with families. Kids take turns blowing the siren of a police car and trying to plunge officers into a dunk tank. Pittsburgh Police Commander Jason Lando led the station for about 5 years before transferring to a new unit last week. He wouldn't discuss the tactics of his predecessors, but says his approach was to reach out to residents.
I would say that over the past few years, I've seen a significant shift in the culture where officers have become much more compassionate and community-oriented.
Lando says officers do what they can to keep residents out of jail and link them to whatever services they might need. And he says people who have been incarcerated help too by mentoring youth they see going down the wrong path.
They contributed to some of the crime and the violence in Homewood, and when they got out of jail, they made a commitment to come back and make up for it.
One of those people is Amber Sloan. She often visits with students at Homewood's Westinghouse High School and organizes an annual community day and other events.
The reason why I come back here is because this is a community everybody forget about.
University of Pittsburgh professor Richard Garland is an expert on prison reentry. He says a lot of people don't return to the communities where they grew up. Garland himself never went back home to Philadelphia after being in prison for more than 12 years. He says it can be hard to shake an old reputation. Those who come back can be targeted by rivals from their drug dealing days or by the victims of their crimes.
Some people don't forget there are barriers and there are challenges in the community that we don't even realize that these men and women face.
Garland says reentrants often lose hope if they're not accepted by the community or can't get a job.
I mean, the self-esteem is something that I always talk to guys about, that you're not a second-class citizen. Okay, that's behind you. But, you know, it's hard.
Zena Scott says she hopes Homewood will grow beyond its past, too. Crime in the neighborhood has dropped since the 1990s, and residents in Homewood say they feel safer today. Scott would like to see people who grew up wanting to leave the neighborhood return to it.
What I really saw the most of is the kids that didn't get involved, got a chance to go away to school or service, and they didn't come back. So drugs took our youth in many ways.
From 2000 to 2010 alone, Homewood's population dropped by 30%. As her grandkids play nearby, Scott says formerly incarcerated people could help to change that.
It would be nice if our young men and women coming out of prison could get jobs in the community to help revitalize the community.
Scott says added attention to prison reentry could make Homewood feel even more like a home. Onley Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
Listen tomorrow to hear more about initiatives already underway in Homewood to help the formerly incarcerated find and keep jobs. You can find more on this series at wesa.fm/homewoodbound. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Cloud computing has infiltrated almost every corner of our working lives. But what about our afterlives? Cemeteries are often managed by technology from the last century. But a Periopolis startup is looking to change that and to bring cemetery management into the modern era. The Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski recently spoke with Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of SemSites, Sean Johnson.
So SemSites, how does this work for cemetery managers?
Well, for cemetery managers, this manages all their business operations. I mean, from the very first call, when someone there's a death and there's a loved one on the other line, they can type those information right there into their online software, and it tracks every aspect from that point forward. Their invoicing, all the way to just the basic ownership information and the obituary information and all the details about the death of a loved one.
Tell me about your clients. Who are you serving now and who are you hoping to serve in the future?
We actually serve cemeteries of all sizes. So our software, it was built the same for each and every cemetery, but it's very customizable. Every single cemetery is laid out differently. And those logistics, those maps, those sections that are all laid out differently pose a lot of different logistical issues that our software solves for them.
How many cemeteries are still using paper maps and paper records?
Probably hundreds of thousands, actually. Very few of them actually have any software whatsoever.
So why do you think so many cemeteries are still relying on paper systems?
To be honest with you, they've got a unique business in their communities, and the business kind of comes to them. And so there's not a lot of change in a cemetery's business over the years. So they pretty much haven't had to change their business model century after century.
Is it because the business is sort of so fragmented, like it's very locally based? You have one person, maybe a few people in charge of a plot of land for a dozen or more grave sites, and is that part of it?
Yes, there are plenty of local cemeteries. There are large management groups that own multiple cemeteries. So even corporate America has infiltrated the cemetery business, but most of them are kind of mom and pop local businesses.
Do you find the cemeteries owned by these larger management companies are more likely to get into the cloud computing, or are they also using these paper records?
Yeah, they're actually the more resistant.
Really?
Yeah, just because they're a larger corporation, there's a lot of things to move and to adopt. And so all of this data, the larger corporations, it's a bigger job for them. You know, it's one thing if I was a local cemetery and I only have 20, 30,000 burials, but the corporation, where they're managed at a corporate office, they have maybe hundreds of locations. And so it's an even bigger job for them.
Yeah.
Even though they may have some larger resources, it's very difficult.
So some sites started in your basement. Tell me how this idea about bringing cloud computing to cemeteries came about.
Yeah, we actually started in my business partner's basement and found that there was actually an association of cemeteries for the country. Never thought that there would be such a thing. You know, you go to trade shows and things like that, and you go to the home show, but you never think that there would be an organization like that for cemeteries.
Sure.
Once we found that, we joined that association. We sent out a large email blast, and some of the largest cemeteries in the country called us interested in our software. So that's when we kind of knew we had something. And we just kept chipping away at that list, and cemetery by cemetery signed on. And just a few years later, we were able to purchase office space.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kylie Kaczynski, and I'm talking with Sean Johnson, the co-founder of SemSites, a company developing cloud software for cemeteries. Sean, organizing records and keeping a clean database is obviously beneficial for those in the business of managing cemeteries, but your software also has real applications for the families of the deceased.
Yeah, absolutely. Once a cemetery enters their records digitally, you know, puts in the names, the births and date of deaths of loved ones, that it becomes searchable online. So it automatically gets published to their website. And beyond that, you can access that with your smartphone, and you can walk directly to the grave of your loved ones. Beyond that, it serves as a great local resource for research for the community, so that they can look up obituaries, find that more information about their loved ones and ancestry. You know, genealogy research is just a huge thing. And all of these larger websites, you know, you think of folks like Ancestry.com and things like that, they depend on data from the local cemeteries.
Yeah, so in addition to research, the mobile navigation feature lets folks find grave sites on a digital map, as you said, with a smartphone and tour the grounds. Do you find this feature valuable for cemeteries, like where famous people might be buried?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great application of it. You know, you think of some of the most famous people in our country, and they always seem to be points of interest for folks.
Could you see this being used in a similar way to help people find unmarked graves or plots without headstones?
Absolutely. You would be amazed at how many headstones, how many graves are not marked. You know, there's no marker, there's no headstone, there's no monument. And no one, you know, just walking through the cemetery, even if you have a somewhat of a recollection of where that person was buried, you can never be sure. And using the smartphone gets you right next to the grave, or right over top of the existing headstone if there was one there. So it's very accurate and takes people right there what they're looking for.
It's a lot quicker than going through a filing cabinet looking for maps to find names and coordinates.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we hear stories all the time of real cemeteries because they don't have something like this. It may take them up to, you know, 20, 35 minutes to find this information.
So for a cemetery manager listening, they have a cabinets full of paper records. What does it look like for them to take those paper records and put them into this software?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. You just start, you can do one file at a time, and you can just either start taking pictures of it with your smartphone. You can purchase larger scanners that will do bulk scanning for you, attach that right into the software, or just start manually entering that information. And what we encourage folks to do in cemeteries is they may think that this is like an impossible task because they have thousands and thousands of records. But if they just start with their most active sections, that's where they're getting the most traffic, the most people coming to visit graves. You know, they're visiting folks that have passed away recently and in their lifetime, not those older sections that have, right, you know, have hundreds of years of history and things like that.
How do you see the market of cloud computing in cemeteries growing?
Yeah, I mean, really, the future of cemetery software is here today. We've had some of this technology now for ourselves well over 8 years, and we really need the cemeteries to adopt and engage with their communities. You know, may not think that you have a need to have an account at your local cemetery, but a lot of cemeteries offer and sell their graves pre-need, so you can pre-plan for your funeral arrangements and things like that. And it's very helpful to do that.
So SemSites recently did a seminar in Notre Dame with members of the community to teach them more about this software. And I understand you're trying to do another seminar locally. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we have a seminar that helps cemeteries, and we take the cemeteries through how technology can really revolutionize and change their cemetery. And we help them with topics of communication and business continuity, and just things that you may not think immediately that technology solves. But we talk about these things in a broader way, and cemeteries are able to walk away with just a wealth of information and things that they can implement today. They don't need to buy an expensive software package to start adopting technology. They can start using some of the things that they may already have right there in their office, but they may not have it. You know, cemeteries are smaller. They don't have an IT person in their building. So we can really help fill that gap through the information they learned at the seminar.
We'll have a link to information about that seminar on our website at wesa.fm. Sean Johnson is the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of SemSites, a software company helping cemeteries digitize their records. Sean, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh-based filmmaker David Bernabo has explored topics from the arts to the food service industry. His latest is Wild Human, an essay-style documentary that investigates our ideas about wilderness. Bernabo spoke with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. The interview references Gavin White, who works for Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy.
You use the title Wild Human, which is, it might sound oxymoronic even to some people. What do you mean by Wild Human?
Well, Gavin White in the film, he brings up an interesting question that I guess is, you know, has been around for a while. Is are humans part of the wild, or are we a natural extension of, you know, natural creation, which we are with evolution and all that. But it seems like humans tend to separate themselves and have we stand apart from our surroundings. And in that, we allow ourselves to influence it in ways that other animals and other plant species and things like that don't impact the environment on such a mass scale.
A big theme of the film is the way we represent nature. How did you get drawn to that theme?
I think there's that idea of the view from nowhere, where any time you see nature or anything you see is a representation because it's going through your retina and your eye, and everybody has a very subjective view of whatever they're looking at. And then you take that and you just extend it to postcards of a national park, a t-shirt, floral prints on your dress, things like that. I think it's interesting how you stop noticing that it's coming from something that's naturally created around you. And it's also kind of funny to talk about. And it's kind of gruesome to talk about with when you talk about like SeaWorld or zoos or things like that that entrap aspects of nature.
Right. And you feature a lot of artists and musicians in the film, which might not be a sort of obvious choice necessarily for a film talking about nature and the environment. Why did you go that route?
So when I started this film, I wanted it to be a bit of a mix of a traditional narrative, kind of a podcast where you don't really see a lot of people on the screen talking, performance film where you actually see musicians performing in front of you, and a road movie, which kind of gave me license to be a little loose with the narrative and the thesis.
And you also talk about, toward the end of the film, virtual reality as a new sort of wilderness, this kind of area that we're exploring as people. I wonder if you could talk about that for a second. What do you mean by a wilderness in terms of virtual reality?
Sure. So Anna Henson is the artist who kind of takes us into that virtual world of mixed reality. And the thing about that is that it's a constructed reality. And Caroline Record, who also is in the film earlier, she talks about creating your own gravity. So you're creating the rules of a world. And I think that's an interesting parallel where you have 100% control, or you have the perception of 100% control, because you're kind of subject to certain technologies that have existed, how they've been built up. Are they used for violent games, things like that?
And then in terms of kind of the importance of this subject matter as something for us to think about as people, as a civilization, you drop almost casually, you know, in the film, the idea that, you know, we're sort of headed in a very disastrous direction. And you don't, the wording that you use doesn't seem to leave much hope that we can avoid that. Is that your real feeling about it?
I mean, I guess I'm a very optimistic person, but I'm pretty cynical about where the Earth will be in the next 30 years. Here in Pittsburgh, it's been raining all summer. So you're already seeing the climate being changed, and you're seeing the impacts of that already. And there seems to be no political will to change course. So I think it's healthy to mentally prepare for change.
Dave Bernabo, thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill.
That was David Bernabo talking with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. Bernabo's film, Wild Human, screens Friday at the Mattress Factory and Saturday at the Carnegie Museum of Art. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, President Trump has issued an executive order that he says will reduce end-stage kidney disease. We'll speak with UPMC's Director of Kidney and Pancreas Transplants. Plus, the leader of the Parks Conservancy is calling on Pittsburghers to vote for a tax increase on themselves to rehab the city's parks. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.